start.
Great.
All right, so we've been doing our section on evidence for Jesus, and I'm going to finish that out here. Okay, from current slide. Let me get on the same slide. Okay. Good. So I want to talk about the resurrection of Jesus. Now, again, I think the arguments about messianic prophecies, for a lot of you, that was not exactly brand new. Hopefully, it's like, well, that's sort of cool. I hadn't thought of it quite that perspective. And again, I'm guessing probably you all have heard an argument for the resurrection. So this is fairly basic Christian evidences. But you know what? They asked me to do a class on Christian evidences, and how could you not cover the resurrection in a class on Christian evidences? So I'm going to treat it as if y'all didn't know a whole lot on this topic, even though I'm sure a lot of you do. All right, and so the resurrection clearly is if not the central myth, the central miracle.
What kind of class is
this?
That's a
Freudian slip if there ever was one. The central miracle of Christianity, you could argue perhaps the incarnation is the central miracle of Christianity, the incarnation rather than the resurrection. But clearly the resurrection is very important. In fact, I think about the resurrection. You know, a lot of times the things we hear about, you know, what about this passage over here? What about this supposed contradiction? But what about the fact that Jesus was raised from the dead? You know? What about my leader? And, you know, what about the resurrection of Jesus, you know? Because if Jesus was raised from the dead, that answers practically every question you could ever ask. It may not answer which cereal you should eat in the morning, but I think it answers every important question, really. And every important question is answered. Maybe you need a little bit more detail there, but in essence, the resurrection of Jesus, it's very important. It's an essential part of Christianity. In 1 Corinthians 15:13-19, Paul says, if Jesus wasn't raised from the dead, then your faith is futile and you're still in your sins.
Yep.
Well, that's certainly true. And in fact, you know, we don't just die with Christ when we're baptized, right? We're raised with Christ. 1 Peter 3, you know, they were saved through baptism. And how? It's right there in 1 Peter 3, through the resurrection of Jesus Christ. If Jesus wasn't raised, then there's no life after death. And in Acts 17, Paul proves that the resurrection happened because of the resurrection of Jesus. And like I said in my sermon on yesterday morning and in Kansas City on Saturday, is that Feast of First Fruits, which is a foreshadow of the resurrection of Jesus. Jesus was raised on the day of first fruits, and basically his resurrection from the dead is the promise of our future resurrection. So that's how we know that we will be raised, is because Jesus was raised. So there's lots of reasons. Now, this is a quote from David Hume, who's the ultimate skeptic, if you know much about David Hume. And he made the rather wise claim, or statement, I guess, extraordinary claims require extraordinary proof. All right, so, I don't know, proving that King David lived, all right, you know, find a couple piece of evidence, a little archaeological thing, tell Dan inscription, whatever. All right, good, we got David lived. Even proving that Jesus lived, you know, it doesn't take that much convincing. You know, hey, there's a guy over there. I just believe you without even looking, you know. There's a guy with three legs over there. I think I'd have to look for myself, you know what I'm saying? And you got to admit, the claim that Jesus was raised from the dead, that is a fairly extraordinary claim.
Yeah.
And you can't blame the skeptic who knows nothing about Christianity for kind of scoffing at that. It certainly wouldn't be a natural occurrence. It would certainly be a miracle if it happened. So I think it's fair to say the burden of proof, if you will, is on the Christian, not on the skeptic, when it comes to the resurrection of Jesus. But I believe we have extraordinary proof, and that's what I want to talk about. Okay? So what we're going to do is I'm going to start with a number of facts. I'm going to start with three facts. I'm going to argue that there's really four facts, but I'm going to stick to three and say the fourth probably as well. Number one, we can say, I think, without any reasonable doubt by any reasonable person, that in fact Jesus was crucified in Jerusalem under the, I don't know, governorship, if you will, under the orders of Pontius Pilate. The evidence for that comes from every source that we have, a wide number of sources, okay, including, obviously, from Christians and from non-Christians. In fact, I'd say virtually everything you know about the history of Christianity, which is essentially the history of the Christian world for the last 2,000 years, it doesn't really make much sense if Jesus was not, in fact, crucified under Pontius Pilate. So I would argue that, in fact, let me see. Yeah. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to go back through these. So fact number one, Jesus was crucified. Fact number two, from the beginning, the church, without exceptions, all claimed he was raised from the dead. Fact, not opinion, not something that we have to really argue about. Fact number three, the tomb was empty. So these are three facts. I think anybody who denies these as facts, they might as well deny that civil war happened. They might as well deny that Julius Caesar lived or Alexander the Great was a general. These are that level of fact. Okay? So he was crucified, fact. All right? The resurrection was preached from the beginning in Jerusalem, fact. The tomb was empty, fact. And then we have to ask, and I'm going to show you why I say they're facts, but then you have to ask, what are reasonable explanations of this? Okay, so we have a fact. The fact is that you're sitting right there. How could we explain that you're sitting right there? Maybe you fell through the ceiling or something like that, or maybe you... maybe he materialized out of nothing, or maybe he walked in and sat down. Now, let's think about what are the reasonable explanations of that. Right? So I let go of this thing, it falls. All right, what's the explanation of that? Maybe because all objects with mass are attracted to each other, or maybe there's gremlins that live under the ground, and when you let, what's a reasonable explanation? Okay, that's what we're talking about here. Okay? So, fact number one, Jesus was crucified under Pontius Pilate. Now, if I was doing this presentation on its own, I would go through these slides, but we've already gone through these slides. So I'm going to skip them. The fact is, though, external historians are unanimous, and these are not some random dudes here. Josephus, who was very reliable and had every reason to deny that he was killed if it could be denied, as well as Tacitus, and the Talmud, and Thallus, and all these other people. Okay. Fact number two, from the very beginning, the church unanimously claimed that Jesus was resurrected. And people who don't agree with this, I say, don't know what they're talking about. Okay? But I believe any clear-headed analysis of the historical facts about the history of Christianity would agree that this was the case. So let's go to Acts 2:24. So we don't want to be arrogant about this. Sometimes when people disagree with you, we could have a discussion about that. Maybe you're right, maybe you're wrong. But sometimes when they disagree on something, it's because they're just plain wrong. If they think it's warm in Columbia, Missouri right now, they're wrong. Okay? And if people think that the church, from the very beginning, from its moment of inception, did not teach to everyone that Jesus was raised from the dead, they're wrong. They're just plain wrong. It's not a matter of opinion. It's not a matter of balancing different arguments and evidence. They're wrong. Acts 2:24, I'll start in 22. Men of Israel, listen to this. Jesus of Nazareth was a man accredited by God to you by miracles, wonders, and signs, which God did among you through him, as you yourselves know. This man was handed over to you by God's set purpose and foreknowledge, and you, with the help of wicked men, put him to death by nailing him to the cross. But God raised him from the dead, freeing him from the agony of death, because it was impossible for death to keep hold on him. Now, could Christianity have begun if people did not believe Jesus was raised from the dead? And the answer is no. I mean, and even historians in the last 10, 20 years or so have come around to making this point, typically, if they're at least open to thinking about it, which is that whether or not Jesus was raised from the dead, it's clear that the early believers thought that he was. Because otherwise you can't explain how a small group of people with no money, no political power, hillbillies, all right, in the smallest, least important area on the edge of the Roman Empire, were able to spread this belief across the greatest empire in the world up at that time, in the face of the fact that their worldview was completely opposed to the worldview of the entire Roman Empire. If you don't allow for the fact that at least they believed that Jesus was raised from the dead, then you cannot explain that historical fact. All right, how else can we explain the growth of the church? And I think the answer is, oops, I keep forgetting to do this. All right, there you go. Sorry about that. So there's what I said 5 minutes ago. There's what I said 4 minutes ago. There's what I said 3 minutes ago. And there's what I just said. All right. It says it right here. I keep forgetting. I'm getting a little tired already. All right. How else to explain the growth of the church? Okay. Oops. Next. What's going on there? Oh, I know what it is. Good. All right. Fact number three. And again, I say this is undeniably a fact. Fact number three, here we go. Fact number one, Jesus was crucified under Pontius Pilate in Jerusalem. Fact number two, the resurrection was preached from the very beginning. Fact number three, the tomb was empty. That's a fact. I guarantee you that tomb was empty. I'll throw it out there. How do I know it's a fact that the tomb was empty? Yeah.
Even the critics were trying to cover
up. Right. What would they have done? They would have produced the body.
Right.
All right. See, obviously, would Christianity have spread across the Roman world if there was this body in Jerusalem that everybody could see for themselves? Of course, it would have decomposed eventually, but, you know, could that possibly have happened? Do you think the Jews would have, you know, kept the body hidden? You know, the tomb was empty. Okay? These are three facts. Now, I could list fact number four, which is that Jesus was alive. In my opinion, that's the fourth fact. But I want to be somewhat humble about this, not to you guys, but to the skeptic out there. And I'm not going to list that as a in-your-face fact. If you don't believe it, excuse me, but you just need to stop not believing it, okay? And I'm going to explain why I think that's the fourth fact. All right, but I'll just list these three facts. So number one is that he was crucified in Jerusalem under Pontius Pilate. Number two, the resurrection was preached. And number three, the tomb was empty. And this thing is not
working.
Yeah, it's on. It just keeps not working. All right, going on. So, what's the most reasonable explanation of these facts? Our poor brother's having a hard time right now. I can't blame him. He's getting a little frustrated. Maybe we should go off to, you know, did they have fries or what do they have for buying electronics here? Just buy a new one. I'll pay for it. Yeah, buy a new one. I'll take it with me when I leave. All right, number one. Possible explanation. Now, if you wanted, let's say you're in the ancient world or even up to fairly close to modern times, who would you go to? If you're looking for, who's going to give you the best argument to explain these facts other than that Jesus was raised from the dead, who would you go to? If you think about it, it's sort of obvious, if you think about it.
Who would you go to for the best?
Who has the most stake in proving that Jesus was not raised from the dead? The Jews. The Jews. So a good question to ask would be, what argument did the Jews use in the following centuries? Okay? What argument did they use? Now, I've heard three explanations for the fact of the empty tomb. Right? Number one is somebody took his body out of the tomb. Okay? Number two, he didn't actually die. called the swoon theory. And number three, Jesus was raised from the dead. Now, if Jesus was raised from the dead, then he's the Son of God. Then he is the resurrection and the life. He's the bread of life. He is the way, the truth, and the life, and all these other things. And I think that argument is, it's virtually inescapable. So no wonder some people are kind of not wanting you to believe that Jesus was raised from the dead. So our three options then. The body was taken from the tomb. He didn't actually die. Or he was raised from the dead. Now, I've heard other theories. You know, the mass hallucination theory, I'll deal with that one. It's like, you know, we're going way downhill really fast. Really fast. Okay, good. The stolen body theory. Okay, good. So who would have stolen the body? Let me see. Would the Jews steal his body?
No.
No? Why not?
Because they didn't
want to shoot. I mean, weren't they the ones that put the seal on the tomb so that nobody could claim to have stolen the body? Resurrected for the sixth time. All right. There's no conceivable reason for the Jews to steal the body. Or put it this way, if they had stolen the body, it's so that they could produce it later. Okay? So obviously the Jews did. What about the Romans? Would the Romans steal the body? Maybe kind of get at the Jews, sort of mess them over, something like that. See, the reason Jesus was killed is because they were claiming he's trying to start a movement, an anti-Roman movement. And clearly, if Jesus' body was not produced and it was claimed as raised from the dead, that's going to cause a problem. It's going to cause a movement that's going to keep growing. In fact, isn't that exactly what happened anyway? So the Jews wouldn't do it. Now, what about the disciples? Would the disciples have stolen his body? Well, why would they steal his body? What possible motivation? Let's steal his body so that we can claim he was raised from the dead, so we can start a religious movement and be hounded to death for the rest of our lives. All right, that's a really good idea. And would they have stolen the body? I mean, what possible reason? Help me out here. Not you guys, just some skeptic or whatever. Help me out here. What possible motivation for stealing the body, other than trying to fake that he was raised from the dead, which doesn't make sense because they didn't even expect him to be raised from the dead? Yeah.
Some classes I've taken, and what I understand is that they were going to make a fake religion to start with and kind of make this
right
idea. Then maybe
it would have been that great. Yeah, right. But this is clearly an irrational explanation, and nobody could believe it. All right, so would they have stolen the body? Now, let's just say they would have. Let's just say they would have, which doesn't make any sense. There's no possible psychological motivation for 12 people to risk their lives and ruin the rest of their lives in order to start a religious movement that they didn't even believe in. But let's just concede that. Now, could they have stolen his body? Well, no, they could not have stolen his body. All right? Why not? Well, because there's, Roman guards there. These were crack soldiers. These were not some dudes, These were serious soldiers.
Right.
All right? I'm just trying to imagine these apostles and their buddies saying, "Hey, man, you got any weapons? I've got a stick, I got this knife for against Roman soldiers." And besides, let's think about it. Now, what would the Jerusalem paper have reported the next day if they'd stolen the body? So they're going to go up against this Roman guard and they're going to, punch them, karate kick them, And then we're going to leave dozens of soldiers dead. All right, let's say they could have, which they could. Do you think somebody might have noticed? Somebody might have noticed? I mean, surely more of the followers of Jesus would have died than Roman soldiers. Surely the Roman soldiers could have taken out at least 10 to 1. So wherever the 120 people in the upper room later on, they wouldn't have existed anymore. So would they have stolen his body? that's ridiculous. That's beyond even being worth proposing. And let's say that they would have. Could they have? I mean, you know, the facts say they couldn't have. And besides, did they? Well, obviously they didn't. How do you know it's obvious they didn't? Because there was not dozens of bodies lying around. Another reason it's obvious the body wasn't stolen is because there wasn't even a body. Because hundreds and hundreds of people saw him and he was alive. All right, I purposely didn't put that on the screen here because I'm trying to act as if that's not so obvious. I don't want to put the skeptic in too bad a place right away. All right. But I think it is worth... In fact, let's go to 1 Corinthians 15. 1 Corinthians 15. So would they have done it? Help me out here. If anybody can give me even a possibly slightly believable reason they would have done it, I'd like to hear it. I haven't heard one yet. All right, let's say they would. Could they have? Well, obviously not. Did they? Even then, obviously not. One of the reasons is because he was still alive. 1 Corinthians 15. I love the way Paul puts it. I detect a note of sarcasm here, I think, anyway. Let me see. Yeah. Verse 3. For what I received, I pass on to you as of first importance, that Christ died for our sins according to the Scriptures, that he was buried and raised from the dead on the third day according to the Scriptures, that he appeared to Peter and then to the 12, and that he appeared to more than 500 of the brothers at the same time, most of whom are still living, though some have fallen asleep. So it's like Paul saying, if you don't believe it, ask him. Just ask any one of them. He wrote this letter probably in the 50s, around 25 years. And again, of the 500 eyewitnesses, I don't know, how many would you guess have died in the last 25 years? Maybe 20%. So, I don't know, let's say 400 are still alive. Saying, if you don't believe it, just ask any of them. And these witnesses, it's not as if they were hiding in the dark. It's not as if people were not aware of them. Paul's saying, you know, believe me, ask them. There were hundreds of eyewitnesses. All right? And so, clearly, one of the reasons I know they didn't steal the body from the tomb is because there wasn't a body, because the guy was alive. So that brings us to the second theory, the swoon theory. This first theory, the stolen body theory, is completely discredited. I don't know. Most people just ignore the subject rather than even bother to defend this theory. Then there's the swoon theory, which, in my opinion, is even more ridiculous. So the idea is, yeah, it's true. He'd gone without food and water for, you know, 2 or 3 days. Yeah, it's true. He'd been beaten mercilessly to the point where he almost certainly would have died anyway. Never mind that. Yeah, it's probably true he got crucified. Yeah, and he was hanging from the cross. And by the way, the whole thing with the breaking of the legs, the deal is when you're hanging like this, stretched like this, you can't breathe if all the weight is on your arms. You can't do it. And so you have to push up. That's the horror of crucifixion. All right. And so if a person hangs limp, let's say, I don't know, he's faking, he's dead, or I don't know, whatever you're going to propose here, I don't know. I mean, the bottom line is, if somebody's hanging limp in a crucifixion, they're dead. Maybe within 2 or 3 minutes, certainly within 5 minutes. And he'd clearly been hanging there for a while. All right, the guy was dead. But then the idea is, then they took that spear and put it up into his side, and John reports that water separated from blood came out. I don't know how much medical knowledge John had. I'm not sure if he was aware that the blood plasma separates, the plasma separates from the cells about half an hour to an hour or so after you die. So this was evidence not only that he was dead, but that he was dead, he'd been dead for at least half an hour. All right. And so here's this guy who's no food or no water, was beaten nearly to death, or perhaps even to death, was crucified, was dead, hanging limp on the cross for a long time, clearly dead, and then was given a wound which would kill anybody, which didn't need to because he was already dead because he's already separated blood and water. And then they put him in the tomb. He's laying there for a couple of days, and he's like, "Oops!" He brushes himself off. All right, he rolls away this huge stone, and then he karate chops the soldiers, you know. He knocks them all out. And, of course, they don't remember being karate chopped. They don't remember that. They just have bruises on their head because he miraculously did a mind meld, Men in Black sort of thing to them. Yeah, that's the swoon theory. That's what I'm saying. So we got three options. Somebody took his body. But I've never heard of a rational person propose even a possible reasonable thing of who might have. Nobody would have, but so clearly they didn't. But even if they would have, they couldn't have. Even if they would have and they could have, but they wouldn't and they couldn't, they didn't. All right? And then the swoon theory. Okay? That's it, as far as I know. And then there's the mass hallucination theory. I got a letter at my website just day before yesterday on this one. Anyways, Bart Ehrman, you know much about Bart Ehrman. He's not a friend of Christianity. And he said, mass hallucinations are a common phenomenon. It happens all the time. It's like, Bart Ehrman, you're come on. All right, so do you have a single example? Yeah, what about the Our Lady of, what's her, the things in Spain, Our Lady of Fatima or whatever. That's your analogy? Or Medjugorje, you know, those Catholic things that happened there in Yugoslavia. It's not Yugoslavia anymore, but whatever. That's not what we're talking about. So Our Lady of Fatima, one person had this vision. One person had a vision. And then, you know, a few months later, another person had a different vision. All right, fine. And other people go there, and some people think they got healed. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about over 500 people having simultaneously the exact same vision. And Bart Ehrman is claiming this is a common phenomenon. That's a lie. That is an out-and-out, utter lie. And yet he publishes this, and we're supposed to believe it. I'm telling you, there is not a single case ever recorded anywhere in history, period, of 500 people having the same hallucination. Wow. And that's the thing. That's what, you know, we get intimidated by these people that make the dumbest. I mean, people actually believe this stuff. All right? Not only the 500, but this hallucination, he ate fish. You know what I'm saying? He ate fish. I don't know. Did he swallow the bones or spit them out? I don't really know. Do hallucinations eat fish? I don't know. I don't think so. So, you know what? Jesus was raised from the dead. He was raised from the dead. And like I said, in my opinion, there's really four facts. I mean, four facts beyond any reasonable doubt. Now, I've been on a jury. I was on a jury a couple years ago, and this guy did it beyond a reasonable doubt, all right? I mean, his DNA was on the gun. His DNA was on the bullets in the gun. All right? His cell phone was used to make a call to somebody in the parking lot of that bank exactly seven, whatever, the exact same time. And there's one lady in that jury who didn't agree that he'd done it beyond a reasonable doubt. Well, I don't know how you deal with people like that. She was a nice lady. But, you know, what's the definition of reasonable doubt? But I believe Jesus was raised from the dead. Beyond a reasonable doubt. Yeah, and one thing I want to just say, kind of a generic statement about Christianity in general. One thing I think we need to do is we need to learn how to separate the things we know because of the evidence from the things we believe by faith. All right, and let me list a few things that I know from the evidence, and therefore to deny it is to be irrational. And one thing I know from the evidence is that the Bible is inspired by God. I don't care what happens. You know, my you know, my church could fall apart. You know, every Christian in the world could go, you know, leave the faith. But it's a fact. The Bible is inspired by God. Number one. Number two, the universe was created. Number three, life was created. All right. Number four, Jesus was raised from the dead. Now, if I have those four, you know, some of the other stuff I don't really have to exactly have figured out. And that allows me to believe some things by faith. For example, I'm going to tell you right now, I believe in Adam and Eve. I believe in Adam and Eve, just, you know, I do. But I believe in Adam and Eve by faith. Okay?
Yeah.
Got that?
Yeah.
Faith based on what? I don't know. You're coming up to an intersection. The light turns green. You go. Based on faith. Faith in what? That the other people are going to stop. Now, which takes more faith? I say it takes a lot more faith to drive through that green light than it takes to believe the Bible is inspired by God.
Yep.
And I'll tell you one thing. It takes a lot more faith to be an atheist. Oh, my goodness. So I believe that I'm going to go to heaven. But I have no evidence. For me to try to tell you I can prove I'm going to go to heaven, that's ridiculous. I believe God's in control. Now, I have some evidence that God is in control, but it's the kind of evidence that, you know, it's personal, it's experiential, and ultimately, I don't try to use experiential stuff to try to convince people because, to be honest with you, experiential evidence should probably stay as that. It probably should. All right? And I, like I said, I believe in Adam and Eve, but I believe it because it's in the Bible. You know, I believe that David killed Goliath with a stone. And I don't have any historical evidence for that. Let's say we found the rock that was used. Do you think you could take the DNA on the rock and kind of analyze it, figure out Goliath's lineage and kind of work back? No! So Christianity will be based on faith. And I think we need to kind of learn to some extent to compartmentalize and kind of recognize the things we know by faith. But for me that helps because, you know, stuff happens and I kind of go, well, Jesus was raised from the dead, you know. The Bible is inspired by God. You know, people bring up doubts. You know, what about this? And what about, how do you explain this? Well, I don't know. I don't really have to explain it. Because the Bible is inspired by God.
Right.
You know, well, what if this, you know, this thing got copied and therefore this particular verse is changed? So what? All right, so I think that's worth bearing in mind. All right, great. So that, I think that ends that one. Resurrection was prophesied, prophetic implications. All right, great. And then the ascension, all that sort of stuff. Great. Oh, how did we get there? Oh, did you put them together in the same? Yeah. You must have. All right, great. That's the next presentation. Okay, good. So, but for me, I have to hit the escape button, and I have to pull up the next thing. Okay, great. Reliability and inspiration of the Bible. In the meantime, are there any questions? Questions? Come on now.
It's a comment. I appreciate the explanation there, or I guess the charge to distinguish between evidence and faith.
Right.
And the
examples
of that. Very good.
Yeah, thank you. It's important. I think it's important because, you know, you can't take faith out of Christianity because it's not Christianity. And sometimes people are expecting evidence that it's going to be okay. And you can't give them evidence. All you can say is it's going to be okay. Well, how's it going to be? I don't know how it's going to be okay. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. I mean, they didn't know how it was going to work out. They certainly didn't have any evidence they were going to escape from the flames. Yeah, good. Good point. Thank you. All right. Here again, this is another one of our courses, and we already had this. Oops. There you go. Uh-oh. That's all right. It worked for a while. All right. Great. So now I'm going to talk about the reliability of the Bible. Inspiration, inerrancy, and reliability of the Bible. That's important. Now, this whole section we did on Jesus, that was you know, weapons. That stuff you want to get that stuff out there. The idea of messianic prophecies, claims of Jesus and the resurrection. Got that? Messianic prophecies, claims of Jesus, the resurrection, and I kind of skipped the whole thing about the miracles of Jesus because of time. Those are four sort of evangelistic tools, Christian evidence tools you can have. Now I'm back to defending as opposed to, using this to convert people. So these are things related to defending the Bible. Okay, great. Good job, brother. All right, so how to handle apologetic questions, New Testament documents, New Testament canon, Old Testament documents, Old Testament canon, scriptures and other religions, defense of biblical inspiration, defense of biblical inerrancy, dealing with supposed Bible contradictions, etc. Okay, so that's the whole idea about the reliability of the Bible. So let's work on that for a while. This is just some comments. I don't know if we need to go through this. I'll go ahead and make these comments. When you're defending the Bible, I think this is just sort of generic comments on how to deal with questions that people bring up. Don't overreach. Don't oversell the evidence. It's tempting to use arguments that are, you know, not completely solid. There's lots of times I've made arguments, and later on I realize that argument, there's a hole in the argument. Most people don't know the hole in the argument, so why not just use it? The answer is, don't use it. Right? Just don't use it. Well, using, arguments that are a little questionable, first of all, it's not completely honest. Second of all, people might be aware of that. Also, you want to, use a violent analogy, you want to keep some weapons in your gun, if you will. All right? So you want to make a point. And then they come back with something. You've got another point. You want to keep some of those bullets in your guns. Help me out with a less violent analogy to this. All right? Don't oversell the evidence. Because, well, for example, with messianic prophecies. I mean, or even in the lesson I did yesterday morning, there's so much more stuff. And so often, when you're doing a debate, you can look at some of Doug's debate that he's done. What he does is he saves his best arguments for last. He doesn't even bring them up in the introduction. All right, so somebody has this, they're trying to deal with that. You show that how that doesn't make sense, and he says, what about this? That's rhetoric. That's a rhetorical tactic there. Don't paint yourself into the corner. This is especially important in talking about the inspiration and inerrancy of the Bible. All right, is the Bible inerrant? Well, we're going to find that that's the answer is yes, it's inerrant. But the way you present that claim, I think, is important. We'll talk about that. So, particularly in reliability of the Bible. For example, saying, the New Testament canon has been set since 70 AD, and anybody doesn't agree with that, it's probably better to be a little bit more conservative, because it's my opinion that the New Testament was essentially set by the first half of the second century. I believe that. I believe that there was virtually no significant doubt about all 27 books. But when I'm giving a class on this topic, I present a more conservative version of that. All right? And then what I've got is plenty of evidence that I can up the game. Okay? Don't undersell. Don't be afraid to say confidently what you believe. But don't undersell. Leave some ammunition. There you go. Leave some ammunition. Be confident. You know what? You're right. That's the bottom line is. You're right. How do you know you're right? Well, because the Bible's inspired by God, and therefore you're right. So this person who may be presenting an argument that you have no idea why they're wrong and you're right, fact is, they're wrong and you're right. Okay? You have this nice advantage, which is that you're right. Now, not on everything, don't get me wrong, but on the question of whether Jesus is who he said he is, whether the Bible is inspired by God, whether you need to be baptized to be, blah, 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 on these basic things, you're right, they're wrong. I know, it's kind of nice being right. And it should give you some confidence. Even at the end of the argument, you find yourself blah, 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 blah. All right, fine, but you're right. You're right. Even though you don't know why you're right, you're right. I think that's worth bearing in mind. I don't know about you. All right. So anyway, we're going to talk about the reliability of the New Testament. There's this common thing. People say, you know, the New Testament books were written in the second century, and this was, you know, decades and decades after the original events. And these things, they just created the story in order to create the false impression that Jesus was who he never said he was. And, you know, you've probably heard this, there's dozens of different gospels. There's the four, but the early church, there was this battle. There were dozens of different gospels, and there was the gospel of Thomas, and the gospel of Philip, and the gospel of Mary, those mean, ugly, terrible, horrible, orthodox Christians, they killed all the people that didn't agree with them and didn't accept it. And so finally, there's only four, but that was until 350 AD, and, you know, you've heard about Constantine, and he changed the New Testament. Give me a break. These people don't know what they're talking about. But anyway, that's what you hear. All right, Constantine became an emperor, and he took, you know, everybody, their favorite doctrine was taken out of the Bible by Constantine. I don't know if you understand how silly that proposal is, that Constantine could have. Anyway, Bart Ehrman, he's the biggest dude in this whole thing, saying that the New Testament was changed and there's almost nothing left of it that you could even believe anymore and this kind of stuff. So these are things that are going to come out. You're going to hear this. People have heard a lot of this stuff. Bart Ehrman, if nothing else, talks really loud. And the History Channel, which is, of course, totally reliable, is completely great at separating good stuff from bad stuff, as you know. And the magazines and websites just do a really great job of giving people clear-eyed, reliable information. So this stuff's going to be out there. I think we need to be prepared to answer it. And I think probably this is important for our younger Christians to have this kind of information. So I think you should consider at least presenting some of this in your ministries. All right, let's see. I've got a little section on the Gospel of Judas. I'm going to skip that, even though that's kind of interesting. I'm going to skip all that. It's kind of cool in a way. It basically would stand in for all these other supposed gospels. You know, the Gospel of Thomas, you've heard of the Gospel of Thomas. There's an interesting thing in there where basically it's talking about Mary. And something like, Mary had to die and come back as a man because no woman could go to heaven. There's weird stuff like that. Yeah. There's some, in the Gospel of Thomas, there's a couple of quotes that are kind of recognizable. And there's a few quotes that are, they sound like what Jesus would say. And then there's this stuff, it's like, you're kidding. You know, if you want to have your confidence in the New Testament to be built up, go ahead and read some of these other things. In fact, don't just read the Gospel of Thomas or some of these other, the Gospel of Judas. In the Gospel of Judas, the God of the Old Testament is an angry, horrible, disgusting creature. And, you know, and Jesus is an emanation of an emanation of an emanation. And in the Gospel of Judas, Judas is the good guy. And Jesus says to Judas, thank you very much for getting me killed, because now I can get rid of this body that I was never me anyway. You know. All right, and you compare that to Matthew. Here's an interesting fact. This is a fact. There were these Gnostics, all right, and they were writing all these things in the second and third century. There was a guy named Martian. That doesn't mean he comes from Mars. His name happened to be Martian, M-A-R-C-I-O-N. And Martian produced his own list of scriptures, and he eliminated all the Gospels except Luke. He eliminated, basically, it was the letters of Paul and Luke and part of Acts, and that was it. You know what he didn't include is any of these other books. Even these Gnostics who wrote these books never, ever tried to put them in the Christian canon. The canon, this is a fact. I'm not just saying this so you'll believe me. This is a fact. The canon of the Gnostic movements were the same 27 books we have. All right? But these people don't say that. All right, Da Vinci Code. Yeah, I don't know if you guys remember the Da Vinci Code. I'm just getting, that's so old, probably kids don't even remember that anymore, but all right. Let me see here. Yeah. Almost everything our fathers taught us about Christ is false. Da Vinci Code. All right, there's a good one. Constantine turned Jesus into a deity who had existed beyond the scope of the human world, an entity whose power was unchallengeable. It was all about power. The early church literally stole Jesus from its original followers, hijacking his human message, shrouding it in an impenetrable cloak of divinity, and using it to expand their own power. So the claim here is Constantine and a bunch of other dirty, ugly, terrible Orthodox Christians, they changed the New Testament, and they changed it so it said Jesus was God. Okay? And I want you to kind of understand why that doesn't make any sense. All right, let me skip. Oh, he mentions the 80 different Gospels in that thing. There aren't even 80. In fact, the Gospel of Judas, you know the Gospel of Judas? The Gospel of Judas does not have the account of Jesus' birth. It does not have the account of Jesus doing any miracles. It doesn't have Jesus telling any parables. It doesn't have Jesus dying. It doesn't have Jesus raising from the dead. So how is that a gospel?
Yeah, no,
all right.
Good news.
It doesn't have anything that a gospel would have. Neither does the Gospel of Thomas have any of those things. So these other supposed replacement gospels don't have the story about the death and resurrection of Jesus. All right, so, you know, anyway. All right, let me get to the good stuff. Okay, good. So let's talk about the manuscripts. All right, we have manuscripts, canon, scroll, codex. These are all nice little big long fancy words. I'll skip all those definitions even though they're nice definitions. Papyrus, vellum, parchment, uncial, cursive, minuscule. That's all fancy terminology. All right, here we go. This is an uncial manuscript. This would be the oldest kind. Let's pretend I was pointing at it. All right? Go to the center of that circle. That's an uncial manuscript. That's Greek manuscripts as written. They were all capitals. No separation between words or paragraphs. They just first letter in the book of John, letter, 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 last letter in the book of John. Would it be more difficult to make accurate copies of these things than an accurate copy of, say, something written with spaces between the words? Yes. This is a minuscule. Minuscules, that would have capitals and small letters. Those weren't produced until, I believe, somewhere around the 6th or 7th century. So all the early manuscripts are uncials. I don't even know if that's how you pronounce it. That's my best job. By the way, here's the trick. If you don't know how to pronounce big words in the Bible, just say it really fast and sound very confident. They'll never know the difference. All right? Don't do this. Just pretend. It's a godly kind of pretending. All right? So this is a codex. Codices were on vellum. Vellum is made from skin. All right, skin of calves, typically. Codex Vaticanus, Sinaiticus, these are the most important manuscripts. The most important manuscripts are vellum manuscripts, but the earliest manuscripts are papyrus. All right, there was a war between Alexandria and Pergamum, essentially, and Alexandria cut off the supply of papyrus to the Greek churches, so they started doing more vellum and less papyrus. Plus, there was less papyrus there in Egypt. They kept cutting it down. Okay, so these are different manuscripts. All right. This kind of gives you a feeling for the reliability of the New Testament just in terms of sheer numbers. All right. The claim is that the New Testament we read is not an accurate reflection of what was originally written. I want to show you that that's not really a very accurate statement. All right, so we have the writings of Julius Caesar. We have 10 copies. I don't know if any of them are full. Probably none of them are. The oldest we have is from 950 years after the original. All right, so in other words, Julius Caesar had been written copies of copies of copies of the copies 950 years between the original and the oldest that we have. What about Herodotus? Herodotus, the greatest historian of the ancient world. All right, we have 8 copies, none of them complete. The oldest one we have is 1,350 years removed. Now, when people read Herodotus, they study Herodotus, do they say, oh, totally unreliable. What we're reading is nothing like what he wrote. Did they say that?
No.
Why not? Because it's not at stake. They have to repent of their sins and become a Christian. You know, there's no reason for them to say no. Okay. There's also no reason to say it about the New Testament. Were mistakes copied into Herodotus? Of course they were. How could they not have been? And were there in the New Testament? Of course there were. How could there not have been? In the case of the New Testament, we have 8,000. Okay? And to say that we have more information about the Greek New Testament than any other ancient book is, to say the least. And the ancient book we have the second most information about, by far, to say the least, is the Old Testament. And then, and, you know, what about, there's, let me see, we do have quite a few copies of Homer, 643. So the bottom line is, the New Testament is so ridiculously far above, you know, any other ancient book in terms of how confident we can be of the quality of the manuscripts we have. You know, it's funny, in Islam it's quite different. In Islam, they claim that their Quran is perfect. Okay? They claim it's perfect. In other words, they claim there are no changes. There have been no changes. Now, the reason they do that is there was one of the colleagues, Umar, what he did was he burned every copy and he made it a capital punishment to have any manuscript other than the one that he produced. All right? Well, no wonder. They're all the same, you know? And they say, and our Muslim friends say, oh, there's so many errors and mistakes and stuff in the Bible. Right, that's the whole idea. The reason there's all these variations and mistakes and quotes and stuff is because we have thousands and thousands of manuscripts, each independent of the other, each being evidence. All right, so what the Muslims have is no evidence. And what we have is a vast amount of evidence. Now, about 10 or 15 years ago in Sana'a, which is a city in Yemen, they found an ancient Quran from before the Uthman version. All right? Now, they tried to get people to work on it. They could not find a single Muslim scholar willing to touch that thing. You see why, right? Because they all know, they all secretly know that the Quran they have is not perfect. So what they do is they refuse. But see, when Christians find a new manuscript, they say, yeah, it's great, more evidence. When the Muslims find a new manuscript, they say, shh. So they had to go to England to find a scholar willing to even touch that thing. So we have this embarrassment of riches of evidence regarding, you know, the New Testament and the manuscripts. And the thing is, because we have so many different versions, if there's a mistake in one, well, there's 27 others that don't have that mistake. And there's textual criticism can be used to reproduce the original with some minor doubts or questions. Okay, that's what we're talking about here. Okay, good. Here's the Rylands Papyrus. Yeah.
Is that also a useful argument against, say,
Mormonism? No, we have the original manuscript of the Book of Mormon. Now, there are tens of thousands of grammatical errors in it, and they tried to remove all those. In fact, there's a funny quote because one of the early manuscripts of the Book of Mormon was underneath Joseph Smith's house, and they wanted to burn that one too, and hit it. So the first edition of the Book of Mormon is a bit of an embarrassment, but we have copies of it. So, no, we know exactly what he wrote. That's the problem for them. But we know exactly what he wrote. All right, so the Rylands Papyrus, if you go to the Rylands Museum there, it's in Manchester. I actually got to see that one. It's written on both sides. It's papyrus, and they wrote on both sides. It's got John 18:31-33 on the front, and then verse 37 on the back. It's from AD 125. Okay, I don't know when the Book of John was written. Probably around 75 A.D., plus or minus 10 years. So we have a copy that's around 40 to 50 years after the original. All right? Now, let's say Constantine wanted to change the Bible and kind of change the Book of John. The problem was, this papyrus is from 200 years before that time. And the other problem is, see, there were thousands and thousands and thousands of New Testaments all over the Mediterranean. So what's he going to do? Burn them all? Well, did he burn them all? No. And in fact, can you imagine all these Christians who would die? I mean, they'd just gone through the persecution of Decius. Hundreds, perhaps thousands have been killed for their faith. Can you imagine them saying to this guy Constantine, who wasn't even a Christian, saying, sure, you can change our Bible. Why not? You know, go for it. But even if he had, we have hundreds of manuscripts of the New Testament from before the guy was born. You know, the idea that he could have, would have, or did change the New Testament, come on, that is so ridiculous. It's like, all right, so anyway, we have the Rylands fragments. I admit it's small. From the second century, we have, I'm going to guess, around 15 or so manuscripts, something like that. Some of them are, a couple of chapters, a few chapters here and there. We do not have the entire New Testament from the second century. We don't. We have significant, in some cases, very small chunks from within 50 years of the original. And we have, I'm sure it's around 15, I'm going to guess. I'd have to count them from the second century. Okay, good. Here's the Chester Beatty Papyrus. Again, this is from the first century. I think it's from closer to 170 A.D., and this is just one page. I believe the Chester Beatty Papyruses are in Ireland. And you can see it's an uncial. All right. And so this claim that the New Testament is unreliable, that it's gotten changed. It's got some evidence here that says that, I'm sorry, but can you give me a claim that's more believable than that? All right. Good. This is the Bodmer Papyrus. That's an interesting one. That's actually from the 4th century, I do believe. Here's Codex Sinaiticus. And I have to confess to you that I was in the British Library and I took that picture. It was after I took the picture they came over and they threatened to take my camera. All right. Anyway, the Codex Sinaiticus, it's the entire New and Old. It's not just the New Testament. It's the entire New Testament and the entire Old Testament in Greek from 350 AD.
Wow.
All right? And we have the Codex Sinaiticus, the Codex Alexandrinus, which was found in Alexandria. Codex Sinaiticus was found on Mount Sinai. It was found in the trash by a guy who was going through there. He found it in the trash and saved it. It was in the trash that was going to be burned. That was in the 1800s. And then there's the Codex Vaticanus. All right, and the Sinaiticus and Alexandrinus are both in the British Library. And they have some pretty amazing stuff there. Okay, Codex Bezae, which if you're an expert on biblical manuscripts, Codex Bezae is also from the 4th century. And there's some interesting differences between Bezae and Sinaiticus and Alexandrinus and Sinaiticus. But anyway, the bottom line is we have multiple attestations to the Greek New Testament. Okay? This is a bit of a summary. Rylands, Chester Beatty, Bodmer, Vaticanus, Sinaiticus, Alexandrinus, Bezae. All right? Again, Vaticanus, Sinaiticus, Alexandrinus, and Bezae are entire New Testaments. All right? And Bodmer, we saw that one, Beatty, Rylands, and we have a few others that are in the second century. Okay? This is the Magdalene manuscript. It's been estimated to be 175 AD. You get it? We have enough of these. I think we're time to go on to the next thing. All right. There are different strains. In other words, those who study these manuscripts can notice, wow, these manuscripts, because there are slight differences. Let's be honest about it. There are slight differences, a spelling here, a word change there, word order there, and then a couple of fairly significant differences I'll tell you about. And from these things, you can tell It seems to be there were family manuscripts used primarily in the western part of the Roman Empire, but a number of them show up in places like Egypt and Jerusalem and other places. So there was the Western, the Alexandrian, the Byzantine, and that's a bunch of specialized stuff, then I think we'll agree on that. Okay, not only that, we have many translations. We have the Coptic, the Syriac, the Latin, and we have a number of translations, including Latin translations made in the second century. So it's like a snapshot. Even if we don't have the oldest manuscript of the Latin translation, if we know the Latin translation was made in the second century, what we have is a snapshot. It's essentially, this was how the Greek manuscript that existed in the second century, how it was translated into the Latin. Okay, we have a number of those. That number I showed you earlier, 8,000 manuscripts, that's 8,000 manuscripts of the Greek New Testament, not counting the something like 20,000 of Coptic, Syriac, Latin, and other ancient manuscripts. So we have a wealth of information. Now, another thing that would help in determining the reliability of our Greek New Testament is the quotes. Clement of Rome, writing in roughly 95 or perhaps 96 AD, quotes from 10 of the New Testament books, Matthew, Mark, Luke, Acts, Romans, etc. Ignatius, 108 AD. You can see the list of things he quotes from. In fact, it's been stated that you could reproduce the entire New Testament from just quotes of the early fathers before 300 AD. Before, you know, say Constantine, for example. So not only would Constantine have had to burn all the other Bibles, which we know for a fact he didn't, he would have had to dig up all the other things that were lost and attics and caves or whatever that were discovered, you know, 1,500 years later, he would have destroyed all those other ones as well if he wanted to produce a fake Bible. The premise of the Da Vinci Code is really quite interesting. Okay, so nearly an entire New Testament can be reconstructed from quotes of the church fathers in the 3rd and 2nd century. That's a fact. Okay, and again, often they paraphrased. Often they did. So it's not as if you can take their paraphrases as, you can't necessarily improve or correct the New Testament, but it clearly, so it's sort of side evidence, but it's additional evidence so that we can know not only what was in the New Testament, but how the church interpreted it in the second and third century. So that's pretty good to know, I think, as far as giving us some confidence. All right, now let's talk about the mistakes. All right. So there's an uncial manuscript. Now look at the thing below. Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but only he who does. It's a little bit harder to read that than if there's not spaces between the words, correct? Why? Because there's context. And again, if I saw, I don't know, the word, let's say, H-I-L-L. You see the word H-I-L-L. If you're reading a book and it's, if you saw H-I-L-P, you're going to go, H-I-L-P. And you think, one of those letters is obviously wrong. All right, H-I-L-P, P-I-L-P. Oh, H-I-L-L. All right, no. So if you didn't have an uncial manuscript, you could correct errors more easily. All right, so therefore, for that reason, copying errors did creep into the Greek New Testament to a fairly significant number. Now, you might have heard something like this. There are over 100,000 errors in the New Testament. You might have heard that. Well, I'm not sure. There's probably only about 200,000 words in the New Testament. That would mean half the words are wrong. Now, let's be careful, because we have 8,000 manuscripts with 100,000 errors. All right, we already divided 100,000 by 8,000, and we're down to 12. All right, well, that kind of lowers the number a little bit. So when you hear that 10,000 error thing, you know, bear that in mind. Most of these errors involve things like a line that got repeated. All right, so they're copying. You get to the end. Have you ever had that when you're reading and you kind of, all right, so that would happen. All right, or lines that got skipped. Well, why is that not a problem? Because we have thousands of manuscripts. And if a line gets skipped, first of all, when a line gets skipped, you're missing parts of words, you know, because the line would end in the middle of a word. So, you know, these things tended to not change the New Testament. All right, occasionally, people would be reading it. While they're copying, they're also reading. And it's almost better to not read it while you copy it, because if you're reading it, your mind's going to tell you it should be and instead of or something like that. You know, yesterday morning we were doing on the Mountain of the Lord, and I thought it should be, I thought it should have been a different preposition or something like that. So the bottom line is errors crept in. Slips of the pen, lines repeated, scribes attempted to improve the text. Now, there are some cases where we have more than one version of something in Luke and then a parallel version in Matthew. And what these people would do, bless their hearts, is they would have a more difficult reading in Luke, say, than in Matthew. So in Luke, it would say something that's like, wow, that's kind of hard to accept. So they'd say, well, what I'm going to do is I'm going to make the one in Luke be the same as the one in Matthew. They would figure that maybe there's an error there. There wasn't an error there, but, you know, bless their heart, they're trying to. And so generally these things can be detected simply because what experts do is they say, I've got, here's Matthew, here's Luke. Now, in some of the manuscripts, it's different. Some of the manuscripts, it's the same. Common sense says if somebody changed it, it's more likely they're going to change it in order to, in quotes, improve it. So generally, they keep the more difficult reading, the one that's like, really? Jesus said you have to hate your father and mother? You know, hate, you know. So you see what I'm saying? So many of these attempts to improve. And then what? Sometimes what they do is they put a comment in the margin. You know, in is it John 5 or is it John 4? The man at the well. You know, the healing of the man at the well. And there's that part about the angels who go into the water and that kind of stuff. You know what I'm talking about? John, thank you. John 5. Well, probably what happened is one guy, he was copying the Bible and he's putting a little comment in the. Have you ever put comments in the margin of your Bible? The comment was to explain, you know, because it is kind of weird. Why were they going down into the water? Well, apparently, there was this myth about the angels. So he said, here's why they're going down to the water. Right? He kind of wrote in his margin. And probably what happened is somebody who copied his version didn't realize that was in the margin, included in the text, and it got incorporated. Well, my response to that is, so what? So what? Because we have dozens, actually hundreds of manuscripts earlier than that don't include it. And besides, common sense can explain what happened. So this idea that all these errors and things came into the Bible, they can't trust the New Testament. By the way, that's what an interpolation is. An interpolation is when you kind of add a little something in there to explain it. And I'm sure, because we have, in many of these manuscripts, we have lots of interpolations people wrote in the margin, just like we do. All right, and apparently, at least occasionally, some of these things in the margins got incorporated. That wouldn't happen in our Bibles because our Bibles are printed at a printing house. Okay, there you go. Significant textual issues. There's about 60 in number. These are things, for example, a word where there is at least some doubt. I mean, some doubt about what the right word is. 60 out of the entire New Testament.
Yeah.
Out of these 100,000 supposed errors. All right, for example, in Matthew 11:19, but wisdom is proved right by her deeds versus but wisdom is proved right by her children. That's the variant. All right, now, is your faith in Jesus going to be changed by which one we go with? Okay, in fact, basically the one is the interpretation of the other. All right, so I'm going to guess, and I'm just throwing it out there, probably children was the original. And then somebody thought, well, what's that mean? Let me help them out. Deeds. So probably somebody crossed out children, put deeds in the margin. But, all right, so this is one of those 60 errors. And therefore, we throw out the whole New Testament. We don't believe in Christianity, and we can't trust anything. Probably Jesus wasn't raised from the dead. Yeah, probably he really didn't say he was God. And by the way, when Jesus says, before Abraham was born, I am, that's not one of the textual things in doubt. You know what I'm saying? So do we lose the resurrection of Jesus? I mean, do these textual errors, do these bring into doubt whether the Bible says, you know, what are we saying here? Okay. All right. So anyway, by the way, what you can do is you can compare it to Luke 7:35. And I can't remember. Luke 7:35 has one of those. I can't remember which. So probably the one that's different is the correct reading. But, all right, let's just say there's doubt about this. I say there's not much doubt. Let's say there is. Is this going to change Christianity in any way? No. So what's all the hullabaloo? What's, that's an old word. All right, good. All right. Age and quality of witnesses. Unharmonized reading is preferred. The more difficult. These are rules. Age and quality of witnesses. For example, let's say I have a manuscript from the 11th century, which is different from a manuscript from the 2nd century. Which one are you going to prefer? The one from the 2nd century. All right. Now, were there any copying errors in 2nd century manuscripts? Probably. All right, probably. All right, so these are some of the rules that are used. I don't think I'm getting into much detail here. All right, now, there are five, count them, five. There are five significant questions out of the entire New Testament. And I've studied this in detail. Somebody might want to add one to this list, possibly, but I say there's five. All right, the woman caught in adultery, all right, that is found in none of the earliest manuscripts except one. All right, it's not. I don't have the information. I've got my notes has all this in detail. I'm just teaching without my notes. All right, here's my response to the woman caught in adultery. I would say, almost without a doubt, this was from the very, very earliest oral stories about Jesus. In other words, the question wasn't whether Jesus said it. The question is whether it goes there. Did John include it in his original gospel? I don't know. If he did, was it in that particular place in his gospel? My answer is, I don't know. I'm thinking it's entirely possible that it was not in John's gospel. I'm convinced, I wouldn't say beyond a reasonable doubt, I'd say I'm strongly led to conclude, how about that, that this happened, that this thing happened between John and Jesus and the woman caught in adultery, and that therefore people said it's got to go in there somewhere. All right, Acts 8:37. Let's go there. Acts 8:37. Acts 8:37. How are we doing out there? All right. It takes a lot of energy to sit there and think. I know it does. You're probably almost as tired as I am. All right. I'll start with Acts 8:36. As they traveled along the road, they came to some water, and the eunuch said, "Look, here's water. Why shouldn't I be baptized?" Let's go to Acts 8:37, down in your margin there, right? Mm-hmm. Philip said, "If you believe with all your heart, you may." The eunuch answered, "I believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God." We go back into the text, and he gave his orders to stop the chariot. Okay, great. The bottom line is, Acts 8:37 definitely was not in the original. Definitely was not. Because no manuscript before something like the 8th century includes it. So there you go. That's that. There's that one. Right? Not in the Bible. All right, well, people say, well, what about, isn't the King James Version the authorized version? Isn't the King James Version the inspired translation? I mean, I run into those people all the time. And you just have, just try to change the subject because you can't reason with that. All right. In fact, there's no inspired translation. There's no reason to think there's an inspired translation. King James is pretty good translation, but the bottom line is, when they made the King James translation, they were using only something like 5 or 6 Greek manuscripts, and none of them are older than around 1100 AD. So there you go. All right, so that probably would explain why it got in there. Again, if you read Acts 8:37, you can see somebody having put, I bet somebody put it in the margin, and then it got pulled in. Same with 1 John 5:7. These three testify the faith, you know. Again, somebody's trying to explain it, you know. It's kind of a nice explanation. John 5:4, the angel stirred the water. So, and then Mark 16:9-20. So the middle three, Acts 8:37, 1 John 5:7, John 5:4, end of story, they were not in the original. End of story. So much for that, leaving any doubt about our New Testament. All right, John 7 probably was not in the original, but I'd say almost with very little doubt, that actually happened. Jesus actually said that. It was part of the oral tradition that was incorporated at some point. Okay? And then Mark 16, 9 through 20. That's the hardest one of them all. Probably that was not in the original Mark. Okay? Sorry. All right. So if you're trying to tell somebody they need to be baptized, Mark 16 is pretty good on that, you know. Those who believe and are baptized will be saved. Those who do not believe will be condemned. I believe that. I'm convinced of that. But, you know, you may possibly, maybe advisedly, not want to use that particular one to prove to your, you know, paedo-baptist person that, you know, or whatever, you know, that, maybe not. Probably Mark 16, 9 through 20 was not in the original New Testament. Might have been, but I'd say less than 20%, maybe even less than 10%. And then what about Mark? If you end Mark at 16:8, it's kind of a weird ending. So there's theories about that. And to be honest with you, I guess I don't really care. Okay? By the way, which is worse, to add to the Bible or to take away from the Bible? No, not both. They're not equal. Which would be worse, to add to the Bible or take away from the Bible? To add to the Bible! What if you took the entire book of Mark out of the Bible? How much would that change Christianity? Not very much. Not very much. I mean, I'm glad it's there. It's awesome. You know, so you could take one book out of the Bible and, you know, just pick your book, and I'm not sure it would change our religion, you know, hardly at all. All right, but adding to the word, that's to me that's more problematic. All right, and so probably we should be on the conservative side and say that's a great story about the woman caught in adultery, and you know maybe not stake your faith on that particular one. Okay, same with Mark 16, 9 through 20. All right, moving forward here. Yeah, here's another one. Luke 3:22. You are my beloved son, and you I'm well pleased. That's what's found in Vaticanus, Sinaiticus, Alexandrinus. And then, you are my beloved son, today I've begotten you. Now, that's pretty different. So I guess I could have made this your sixth. In fact, I've considered putting this one in that list. Okay, that's interesting. Now, the fact is, Vaticanus, Sinaiticus, and Alexandrinus tend to all be fairly similar to each other. Alright, and this Beze, and then Justin Martyr. Justin Martyr was writing in the 2nd century. So, you know, let's put it out there. And this one's interesting. Now, you are my beloved son, and you are well pleased. You are my beloved son, today I have begotten you. Now, that one's interesting, because we it's hard to say for sure.
That was after Jesus was baptized, right?
Luke 3. Oh, let's turn there. Luke 3:22. All right. Yes. So which is it that Jesus said, "Today I've begotten you," or "In you I am well pleased"? That's have to admit it's fairly different. Then you have to go to Mark 1:11. We could look at Mark 1:11. Mark 1:11 says, "And a voice came from heaven, 'You are my son, whom I love. With you I am well pleased.'" Okay? Now, it's possible, if you go to Psalms 2:7, it's possible that whoever produced the manuscript that led to Beze had incorporated Psalms 2:7 into the text of Luke 3:22 in order to make a point. Now, that's sort of bad in a way. I mean, and of course, Ehrman likes to build this up as if it changes everything. But again, let me ask you a question. Does this change anything about Christianity? For example, is there a question about whether God was pleased in Jesus? And we can go to the Mount of Transfiguration and we can see that he was. All right. was Jesus begotten of the Father? All right. Yes. All right. So I don't see this as raising any significant doctrinal issues. All right, great. So let's move on here. And all right. This, I don't know why I put this in here. Okay, I'll skip that. Even though that's actually Bart Ehrman conceding there's certain things that are clearly true about the New Testament. All right. So scholars have argued, is it 0.1% of the New Testament that's in doubt, or is it 0.2%? All right. The bottom line is, there's no significant point or doctrine or theology that's at stake. In other words, is it and or? Is it in or into? You know, is it in him I'm well pleased, or is it today I've begotten you? All right. I would say it's fairly clear from all these supposed problems that there's no significant issue of doctrine, of theology, of teaching, of facts about Jesus. I would say the bottom line is there's no issues. And those who say there are should give me an example of that. My final conclusion in the New Testament is the Greek text we have at this point is a nearly perfect representation of the autographs of the New Testament, of the originals. 99.9% roughly. And of the 0.1%, the evidence says there's no significant doctrinal or theological questions. That's what the data says. Okay? All right, let's see. How am I doing here? We've been going for an hour and 10 minutes or so. You can start to tell the energy is getting down a little bit. Let me blast through in about 10 minutes a little bit more about the Old and the New Testament and get to a good stopping point, okay? If you'll bear with me. What about the canon of the New Testament? All right, there's the Muratorian fragment, which is called that not because Muratori made it, because this guy Muratori found it. And this fragment has a list of the New Testament books from about 170 A.D., okay, roughly. Okay, here's I'm going to summarize my conclusions and let you ask questions if you want. All right, I'm not going to give you the evidence for this. This is my conclusion based on the evidence. Number one, a collection of Paul's letters, perhaps not including the pastoral epistles, in other words, 1st and 2nd Timothy, was circulating among the churches by 90s A.D. In other words, Romans, 1st and 2nd Corinthians, Galatians, Ephesians, Philippians, Colossians, 1st and 2nd Thessalonians, these books were circulating as a collected letters of Paul to all the churches in the 90s. There's a lot of evidence for this because, for example, some of the early church fathers, you know how when you're doing a study, you kind of do Matthew first, then Mark, then Luke, then and it kind of you're kind of doing a word study, that kind of thing, and you do it in the same order as the books. And there's evidence for this. Number two, the four Gospels also were collected and circulating as four Gospels together in one document in the 90s. All right, so this would mean roughly about 80 to 85% of the New Testament was being circulated as inspired books collected together by the end of the first century. The evidence points towards this. All right. A still fluid but developing list of canonical books being read in the churches by 150, the memoirs of the apostles and all that. So by about 150... The people are beginning to say these are the books of the New Testament. And those lists varied ever so slightly. By about 150, there were roughly five books that there was at least some question about. That would include 2 Peter, it would include Jude, it would include Revelation, Hebrews, and I'm forgetting one. There were four or five books which generally were considered inspired and should be in the canon, but there were at least some people who are saying, I don't know. And you have to understand how the New Testament canon developed. Basically, the New Testament canon was chosen by consensus of the leaders and the people in the New Testament church. All right, since these people were hundreds, if not thousands of miles separated from one another, there was no central body collecting the New Testament. Over time, the consensus was achieved. And you can even read, you can read Irenaeus, you can read Clement of Rome, you can read these early church fathers, and they even discuss why, for example, Hebrews was considered canonical. Okay, got it? All right, development of the New Testament, Irenaeus called the four Gospels the four pillars of the church. By 8200, the New Testament, as we know, was canonized by acclamation of the church. But in 220 AD, Origen, there is still some doubt about Hebrews, 2 Peter, 2nd, 3rd John, Jude, and Revelation. But he listed them. In fact, all of them were listing them. They all had all these books in their canons by the 3rd century. They're just saying it's true that some people were still wondering about, say, Jude or something like that. Now, by the way, in some of these early canons, like one person would have, you know, the 26 of the 27 New Testament books, and only 26, they would include Shepherd of Hermas in their list or Epistle of Barnabas. Now, even when they included these, in fact, Codex Sinaiticus had a couple of those at the end, at the very end. So Codex Sinaiticus, you remember I talked about that one? At the very end, a couple of these are there. They're at the end on purpose, obviously, because they knew they weren't part of the canon. But they were considered them useful for reading. So they make a copy. All right, you get that? So the bottom line is, that's the history of the New Testament canon. All right. Okay, so summary here. The New Testament canon was selected by consensus of the church in the 2nd century as those books with apostolic authority. The evidence is conclusive that the Greek New Testament we have is virtually identical to the original writings of the inspired writers. All right, let me see. Do I really want to launch into the... No, I'm going to take questions. And then I'll take up from here with our next session. Yeah?
So, in the New Testament, the missing verses...
What, the missing ones or the...
Yeah, like we looked at the ones...
Those aren't missing, but...
Well, when they're...
The added ones.
The actual...
The added ones, okay, yeah.
Is that because all those verses, is it because they're not...
For example,
in the early...
Acts 8, if you believe, you can be baptized or whatever. Okay, good. That's not found in Codex Sinaiticus. It's not found in Codex Vaticanus. It's not found in Codex Alexandrinus. It's not found in Codex Beza. In fact, it's found in no manuscripts of the New Testament before either the 8th or the 9th century.
Mm-hmm.
So, obviously, it was not in the original book. Okay?
So all the missing verses...
Forgive me for correcting you. There's not missing verses. These are added ones.
Added verses.
All right. Yeah.
That's why. Because they're not in the earliest
right.
manuscripts.
And so it's not as if there's any debate. These were not in the original.
Okay.
So what's the problem? The answer is there's no problem.
Mm-hmm.
The only possible problem is somebody stuck with the King James Version or something like that. Because the King James includes these. They say, well, you know, how could there not be an Acts 8:37? You know, that's proof the Bible's on fire. Okay, whatever. All right? Now, again, that one that I showed you from Luke, that's something which I'll have to admit, that's only about 4 or 5 words. But that's 4 or 5 words about which there is some doubt. And whereas in 1 John 5, there's no doubt about it. It was not in the original. John 5, no question about it. It was not in the original. It's not even an issue. Okay? Yeah. Anybody else? Yeah.
Do you think if this is enough to hang somebody up, kind of what you're talking about, those early arguments kind of being smoke screens, do you think, you know, something like this can kind of get someone to question the legitimacy of the whole Bible, you know?
Well, certainly that's what Muslims try to do, that's for sure. They try to grossly exaggerate the case. And then it's interesting, what Muslims do, their best friends are atheists and people who hate God and hate Islam. It's kind of, that should make you a little bit, you know, wondering about them. They love Bart Ehrman, but they even have the nerve to abuse Bart Ehrman and make him say stuff that he would never say. That slide that I skipped, basically it's Bart Ehrman saying, when these Muslims claim such and such, they're crazy. That's even Bart Ehrman, who's the most obnoxious atheist guy and God-hater in the world. I'm slightly exaggerating. He might even actually be a nice guy. I never met him, all right? But either way, even Bart Ehrman would say, oh, give me a break. The idea that, you know, that Jesus wasn't, that the Christian church, that Jesus wasn't raised from the dead, or the idea that, you know, some of these things Muslims say about Jesus, you say, you know, give me a break. So, yeah, it, absolutely. Certainly, if you talk to Muslims who've been indoctrinated by these imams, they're already set up to have all this stuff grossly exaggerated into something that it's not. And they're taught this stuff, I guarantee you. Yeah.
One thing you can do, too, just kind of talking about smoke screens, is being able to find out what their real objection is, you know, and if they say something out there that's just kind of ridiculous, you can say, that's a really good question. Besides that, is there anything else that you doubt? And then they throw up another one that's pretty common. They say, okay, so this and this, besides that, is there anything else? Those are really good questions. You know, and that takes their defenses away. Where if you just come back and try and hit their smoke screen, they just close up and you'll never get them to open up. Or if you say, that's a really good question, is there anything else? And you get it all, and you'll get them to the point where they say, no, besides that, that's about it.
Yeah,
and then you can attack it.
Yeah, there's a book that came out a couple years ago by this guy, Kokel. I don't know if you've ever heard of him. And I wouldn't go for his doctrine, but he's pretty good. And the title of the book is Tactics. And he goes into that, and he talks about how to disarm people, how to put them in a defensive position, not as in being defensive towards you, but so, to take the initiative away from where they're trying to steer it, learn how to steer the direction, the conversation in the correct direction, learn to detect, you know, different kinds of arguments, those kind of things. So I don't like everything about that book, to be honest with you, but I think he certainly mentions that kind of thing. Oh, yeah.
You have mentioned, like, the Epistles of Barnabas.
Yeah.
Have you read them? And then your opinion on them?
Yeah, I mean, buy a copy of my book on church history. I summarized the Epistle of Barnabas. These were, the early church fathers wrote all kinds of stuff. All right, and some of these that got circulated. I mean, my books get circulated. All right, and that's all they were. You can read the Epistle of Barnabas. He's there's some stuff that's kind of almost anti-Semitic. In fact, the early church slipped into anti-Semitic stuff. It's kind of embarrassing sometimes. Not all of them, but some of the writers. Anyway, you can read it for yourself. The early church fathers read these books, and they didn't have a trouble distinguishing them. Didache, that's another one. That was a book given to basically to people who are going to get ready to be baptized, explaining the basic doctrines of Christianity and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, it's interesting because it had them doing dipping three times and some other stuff that, you know, that's interesting. But anyway, these were these Epistle of Barnabas, Letter of Clement to Rome. These things were written by faithful, believing Christians, sincere Christians, and that these books are saturated with quotations of the Old and New Testament. And it's convicting how these guys use the scriptures a lot more than we do. I mean, just read any of them; it's quite an instruction. So. Anyway, again, one of the best ways to recognize an inspired thing is to read something that's not inspired. Read Tobit, read Judith, read the Old Testament Apocrypha, read First Enoch, read these things. And then if you want to really see the difference, read these Gnostic Gospels, which are, these are abominations. All right, but the Epistle of Barnabas, you can read the summary. A Just and Martyr. These are generally really good stuff, but there might be a couple of things in there you're like, I don't know about that. Maybe. Yeah?
Was it really written by Barnabas?
No, it wasn't.
Oh, okay.
No. It's pseudepigraphal. We don't know who wrote the Didache, which is perhaps the earliest. Letter of Clement to Rome was probably written by Clement. All right? And the letters of Justin Martyr were probably written by Justin. His last name was not Martyr, by the way. Okay? Any other questions? Yeah?
I was in a Bible study this past semester with this girl who came from a sect of Mormonism.
Mm-hmm.
And we're doing the Word of God study, and she believes that, she doesn't believe that the Bible is the Word of God. She believes that the Word of God is in the Bible.
All right, yeah.
So I don't understand what
you're right, saying. So I think you should do this kind of a study.
Okay.
Because basically, she believes something that, don't say this to her, please. She believes something that's really nonsense. And, see, again, don't say that to her.
Text her right now.
But, because Muslims, even more so, absolutely have to completely decimate the Bible and just basically give you an excuse to ignore the entire thing. And Mormons is not the case. I mean, they clearly will say the Bible, correctly translated, is the Word of God. All right? But fine, you just pull out a Greek New Testament. You can do that and do a little interlinear and say, show me, you know, and talk about this. And so you're saying that, do you have an example?
She just said that.
She won't have one. She won't have one because there are none. And so, you know, but do it gently and definitely don't say what I said, all right? Don't do that. I say, all right, so that's what you think. I wouldn't start with, do you have any examples? You know she doesn't. I wouldn't start with that. I would say, look, you know, you might want to have a Greek interlinear. I've got a Greek Bible. You know, we have these manuscripts in the 2nd and 3rd century, so obviously it's accurate. It's original. So we just read that. So if you think, which translation is it that you think is there one that you think is closer? It's King James, by the way. They totally want you to read the King James because, see, Joseph Smith quoted directly out of the King James as if it were from the Golden Tablets. That's interesting. But it's got to be King James because his is inspired, right? So if the King James is not perfect, then how do you explain that his inspired thing is not perfect? That's kind of problematic for him. So therefore, they believe the only inspired translation is the King James. She may not even know that, but that's the only inspired translation. Now, rather than showing her John 5 and 1 John 5 and why that's not exactly the best, I'd say, let's just work with King James. What's wrong with that? That's fine. I've studied within King James. It's good with me. That way you kind of take, like you're saying, you take away their arguments. I mean, I don't know if I do New World Translation with a Jehovah's Witness. I might not go that far, but I would certainly do King James with a Mormon. Why not? But you know, maybe you know, eventually you might want to do a little study. You might want to say, hey, let's do this study, and kind of show her without even mentioning about King James how we know the originals, blah blah blah, and talk about the manuscripts and. And say, and by the way, none of the manuscripts before this have this one here. You don't even have to say, by the way, you don't even have to say that. Then later on down the road, while she's already figured out, okay, great, that's how we know. Later on down the road, when this thing that's in King James, she's already figured out it works. She'll go, oh, yeah, okay, that makes sense, yeah. So I agree with what you're saying there. Is try not, when you can, try not to force stuff down people's throat. Do not use the tone. Often I've been using the tone today that you don't want to use that tone.
Yeah.
Please. Yeah.
I took a class at KU just called Christianity, and it's just a basic overview of everything, but my teacher referenced the Q for
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Here's the idea. First of all, it's pretty clear that none of the gospel was written, say, in the first 10 years. Probably not. Okay, now, I believe there's an excellent chance Mark was written in the 40s. Certainly by the 50s, that's my opinion. And people always want to push it back as far as possible, including Christian scholars. I don't know why they'd want to do that. So there was an oral tradition, and the gospel was passed around by apostles and inspired teachers. Okay, and then more likely than not, Mark was written down before Matthew, it's not for sure. More likely, and then Luke, and then John. But you know, we can't say for sure. But the thing is, so people have speculated that there are other written sources that were used. Well, maybe there were, maybe there weren't. But we don't know. But people build whole theories on this. So they're trying to say You know, and you have to understand, these are people who don't believe that God exists and the Bible is inspired by God. So, you know, people who have a presupposition the Bible is not inspired by God, they're working from a presupposition that's just flat wrong. All right, so was there a document that they call Q, which is the theoretical source from which Mark drew? And therefore, Matthew drew from Mark and Q. You get that? So the additional stuff in Matthew comes from Mark and Q. I don't know. It doesn't matter. But these are highly speculative things. Highly speculative. And they don't mention that. These scholars and other people, they talk as if Q is a real thing or something like that. You want to know how much evidence there is that this document existed? None. Were there written records or stories about the gospel of Jesus before Mark? Probably. I mean, how could nobody have written? I mean, surely somebody did. Right? So, you know, we're arguing from lack of knowledge. All right? Did Matthew himself have one of these documents in front of him when he wrote? I have no idea. He might have, he might not have. What about Mark? I don't know. I'm pretty sure, though, that Matthew did not have Mark in front of him. I think Matthew had Mark in his mind, but not in front of him. Because if he had Mark in front of him, then they would have been more similar. Okay? So that'd be my guess. So I certainly wouldn't waste any time trying to prove there was no document Q. There's no reason to. So this is speculative stuff created by these guys who are trying to write PhDs and get doctorates, and, you know, they have to have something controversial. All right? It just doesn't really change very much. So, no, there was no document called Q. Clearly, there wasn't. I don't think they would have called it Q. But were there other recordings, written records of the work of the life and times of Jesus? Probably. Did Mark use an actual written source, or was it entirely the oral tradition in his own memory? No. All right.
I have one more question.
Yeah.
So you said it's words to add to the Bible. And then we have the Catholic Bible, and they've added, I think, 5 extra books. So,
a lot more than 5.
Okay. So what's acceptable as far as adding, if it's from early manuscripts, or is there a certain...
There's nothing to be added.
But what about those books in the Catholic Bible?
Well, that's the Apocrypha. Okay, those are additions to the Old Testament. I kind of alluded to that already. Remember I talked about how... All right, sorry about that. The Jews never included that in their canon of scriptures. Never. It was the Christians who tried to pull some well-known Jewish writings into the Jewish Old Testament, Hebrew Old Testament. They shouldn't have done that. But by the 3rd century, it was very common. By the 4th century, it was accepted as if it was no big deal at all to quote from, especially Wisdom and Ecclesiasticus and these books that we call the Old Testament Apocrypha. Okay, but, you know, are any of them inspired? There's some I'm sure are not inspired. There's some that might be, and maybe one or two possibly. It doesn't really matter. All right. Let's say, for example, that First Maccabees was inspired. All right. Fine. It doesn't change anything. So I would say, so therefore my argument would be, no, don't include them. By the way, you should know that in the Reformation, the Protestant churches included those. All right, Luther's Bible included those. The King James included those. It was only in the 1700s that Protestant scholars started to realize, oh, wow, these weren't even originally written in Hebrew. Jerome was right. The Jews are right. And they removed them from their Bibles. All right. Now, I would say if you keep, especially Wisdom and Ecclesiasticus, if you keep those two, that incorporates downright, absolute, utter, false doctrine. And I'll tell you, the Catholic Church loves those books because you can justify demanding not getting married. You can justify indulgences, all kinds of stuff. So they kind of love those. So probably our Catholic friends are not going to be convinced by any evidence to remove them from their scriptures. But as a Christian, I don't see that as a big issue, actually. All right, let's take a break. 10 minutes. All right, how much more do I have to go here? Okay.
Okay, so you've got the Jewish teachers that determine which books would be Old Testament.
Right.
And the Christians determining the books of the New Testament.
Right.
Was it the same Christians that determined the New Testament scriptures that were trying to add the Apocrypha?
Nobody was trying to add the Apocrypha. What it was is, in a very, very gradual process that's hard to delineate, as we're heading into the 3rd century, it became quite common for preachers and teachers to use those writings.
Gotcha.
The reason they did is because they were in the Septuagint. Okay? They were not in the Hebrew Bible. They were not using Hebrew Bibles. They were using the Septuagint. The Septuagint included these things.
Gotcha.
So, unthinkingly, over time, these writings, which were not used at all in the first century, were used only sparingly in the second century, were used all the time in the third century, and were accepted without question by the fourth century. They began to be used because they were in the Septuagint. The Christian Old Testament was the Septuagint, not the Hebrew Bible.
Say that one more time.
The Christian Old Testament was the Septuagint Greek translation.
Gotcha.
Which, unfortunately, Septuagint translations were, these books were added to the ones that were circulated.
Gotcha.
So,
did people ever argue the validity or the process of how they got the New Testament scriptures?
Yeah, they did. You can see Origen explaining why or why not certain books are accepted. Origen would talk about who wrote Hebrews, and Tertullian did as well. So they had all these discussions. They were in there. You can read them. Yeah. And you can even infer, you know, those who did or did not accept the book of Revelation, you can kind of infer why they did or did not. So basically, Revelation was accepted because it was associated with the Apostle John. Ultimately, it was accepted.
So what do you say in response to that? People who question.
What's there to respond to? They're all inspired by God.
Yeah.
They're all in the Bible.
Yeah.
All right. I mean, give me a specific New Testament book. I mean,
yeah.
What about, you know, let's say, I don't know, Jude. Right? Is that inspired by God? Well, I believe it is. Because, I'm going to be honest with you, an element of faith enters here. An element of faith
enters.
But to me, the amount of faith involved in this case is very, very,
sure.
very small.
Sure.
Very small.
Sure.
But it's not zero faith. It's just...
Yeah. And so I was sitting with this guy in... he's having trouble believing that the scriptures are inspired by God. And
this, what guy, from what background?
Just a
random guy.
Just a Christian, which is weird because he believes in God. He believes in.
Well, then why don't you study out the messianic prophecies?
Yeah. Well, because then he'll probably say something like, "Well, I think that's good. I just don't quite believe all the scriptures are."
Well,
how do I know that they were, God's words and not the words of the people writing them?
Well, again, the messianic prophecies obviously weren't the words of the people writing them because no human could have written them. So at this point, what you have is the door open, which is, I don't know about all scripture, but Daniel 9 is inspired. Psalm 22 is inspired. Isaiah 53 is inspired. What that means is there's an inspirer. And how big is the step from there's an inspirer
to
the whole thing's inspired? The step is very small.
That's good.
Sorry. You guys good. Really quickly, who has no idea where the stage is?
I know why.
So,
I'm Mallory's cousin.
Yes,
well,
yeah. Katie. But, I haven't met you, but I just really appreciate all the wisdom that you're giving us.
And thanks.
We got to listen to a lesson the evidence on baptism.
Uh-huh.
And it really helped me this semester with one of the girls I'm studying.
Yes.
She just, they want me to build bridges later because I felt like we were just kind of button heads with things, but then after listening to it, it really helped. So,
good.
Yeah. So thank you.
Yeah, I think Jeremy might have come to that lesson. It was for the singles, but a few college students crashed that lesson.
Well, Evan was one of them.
Evan might have been there,
I heard him ask a couple of questions during it, so I was like, okay, they must be there. But, yeah, it was great. It was really great.
Yeah.
Yeah. Where would you suggest just start? I feel like, you know, I listen to you, and I know it's, you know, years of studying, but where would you begin?
By the books I've got back there, it'd be a great place. Reasons for Belief would be good. Yeah.
And
absolutely.
Are those
Daniel, Prophets of the Nations?
Get them here. There are just a couple that had one copy or.
No, please, buy it. If it's there, buy it.
That'd be great. Yeah. Thank you.
I'm going to go back to the one on history and archaeology is going to be next.
That one or no? Or the
I'm not done with that one.
Okay, but
the one on history and archaeology will be next.
Okay.
You guys want some books? Let me know. They're for sale. 15. They're all for sale. I mean, don't hold back. I mean, you know, that's. I don't want to carry them home. I've got a few more in my room. Not many. I'll have them here tomorrow, but yeah, help me out here. I don't want to have to bring these home. They're heavy. Yeah, that's a good place. I mean, this is kind of nice because this is like, I don't know, 250 different questions that have come into my website.
Okay.
And my attempt at answering them. So, Field Manual for Christian Apologetics. That would be useful for me if I was getting started. Did you hear the lesson I gave here yesterday?
No.
Right.
But I wrote it down. I'm glad.
Yeah,
that's
the book there. That's some pretty cool stuff.
Yeah, that was great. I'm looking
forward
to
it. Is it
on
your church Facebook? Is it Columbia? Okay.
Yep.
And that one's 13.
Okay.
And this is pretty good here. Okay. So just trying to get a general background of world religions. And we do it, from a worldview perspective to kind of help out. That's like, I don't know, probably 12 hours worth of material.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Great.
Well, those are things to get if you want. I wish they were free, but I can't, I can't do that. I'd like to give them away for free, but... I'll make up. I don't have prices on those. I'll make it up. Those are all 10.
Okay.
Over there, those are all 10.
I know Willie wanted some too, so we'll just bring a bunch now.
Great.
Thank you.
You bet.
Oh.
Hey, John, do you have your PowerPoint with like annotated with your lessons at all?
Yeah, sure.
You
on my website.
On your website.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I'd like to look at that.
So. Plus, you can take any of these. You can take the courses
okay.
where I'm actually teaching the full version, not the partial version.
Great.
All right. So.
I need to write here.
So the other one that needs to come up is the one on history and archaeology in the Bible. Okay, great. Right. I'm going to use that one next. I'll get to that during this session. All right, let's get started. Last session. Are you guys getting low on energy yet?
Oh, we're good. We're better now. If you get too much, run outside.